Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the latest results from the SPAR Group. They provided us with an update on the year that was financially. We're going to reflect on that and make sense of those numbers. We also have a conversation taking a look at Netflix's latest $72 billion deal with Warner Brothers and what we make of that. We're going to speak to the sales director at Reach Africa, Leslie Adams, around that and get his thoughts around how that deal could potentially affect the streaming landscape in South Africa and around the world. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the investigation Truecaller finds themselves under by the Information Regulator of South Africa. We're going to try and make sense of that and how it could potentially impact us as consumers. We also have a conversation taking a look at the consumption market, particularly the luxury market, with the co-founder of Luxity, Michael Zahariev, trying to take a look at how the luxury markets have performed and how the South African luxury market has fared against its global peers. Then, because it's Monday, we've got a personal finance conversation. We're going to wrap up the show taking a look at travel insurance and trying to understand everything we need to know about it.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off the show with a sense of market movements throughout the day and see if we can make heads or tails of what's been driving some of these market factors. I'm joined on the line by the portfolio manager and director at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at market movements, see what we make of them. Now, Gary, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Not the best start to the week from an equity perspective, but seemingly a mixed bag if I look at international markets as well. What do you make of how we've started off the markets from an equity perspective?
Yeah, ugly start of the week, but I think a little bit of this is the US dollar recovering. So it's been pretty broad-based. So after, you know, the South African rand dollar pair closing, what, about 16.92, back above 17, so around 17.03 at the moment, so lost ground against the US dollar. And I think that just took the shine off a lot of markets internationally, just that slightly stronger dollar. So we had the All Share Index down just under 1.5%. We had the Resource Index, obviously, you know, pricing a lot of the underlying commodities that were sliding. That was down around 2.5%. Industrial index down 1.3%. Financial index doing a little bit better. And maybe that was Absa's trading update. That only down 0.91% for the day. I've had gold slipping back around 0.33%. Bitcoin down again. Even Brent crude oil was down 1.1%. So we're trading around $63 a barrel. So it really was broad-based. We're seeing it also in the S&P 500, NASDAQ, each down around 0.33%. So red really across the board. The only thing that has been gaining is the US dollar. And that leads me to believe this is just a little bit of nerves, maybe a little bit of profit taking ahead of that crucial December 10th Fed announcement.
Gary, we'll get into that announcement. Perhaps let's get into that announcement now alongside other US developments. We got non-farms data out last week. We've been seeing that we got private jobs data out leading up to that as well. We're back in a space where we are getting data out of the US following that US shutdown earlier in the year, which we've had to contend with. But at the same time, I want to get a sense of how markets are reacting to that and the importance of that Fed announcement that takes place on the 10th.
So I think the Fed announcement, it's going to be an interesting one. There's no question. And as you said, it ties into the non-farm data. It ties into the, you know, the just how opaque the data has been, you know, thanks to the U.S. government shutdown. So, you know, currently the Fed funds futures are pricing in an 88% probability that we get a 25 basis point rate cut on Wednesday. But one of the traders on the desk literally walked across to me and said, I think there might be a surprise. And one of the reasons is that if you look at it, 5 out of the 12 policymakers are suggesting that rates should remain unchanged. And we know that the Fed is probably a little bit more concerned. Remember, the Fed has a dual mandate. So they've got to, you know, obviously, you know, try and improve growth, but they've also obviously got to contain inflation. And at this stage, the inflation picture looks maybe a little bit more benign, and they probably are more concerned around sluggish growth, you know, the kind of concerns that we've seen in the US labor market. So I think that's why the base case is that we're going to get this cut. But, you know, 5 out of 12 policymakers saying unchanged, you know, it's definitely not a foregone conclusion. And an 88% chance is maybe overdoing it a little bit. Maybe the market's pricing in a little bit too much. I think it's going to be an interesting one to watch. There's no question about that. I think also just around the Fed specifically, there's been a lot of talk about who will replace Jerome Powell, you know, when his term comes to the end. Trump has come out and said, you know, he'll announce early next year. We're not going to get it, you know, over December. But at the moment, it looks like the front runner is Kevin Hassett, who's the director of the National Economic Council. But that also remains to be seen. So I think there's kind of a lot of moving parts there. And I think that commentary, you know, on Wednesday is going to be absolutely critical to, so as one, keep the rally going, but also it's going to be absolutely key for pairs like the Rand dollar. You know, you obviously mentioned the non-farm payrolls, and that really feeds into it. But, you know, if we look at the most recent Fed announcement and the commentary afterwards, Jerome Powell was very clear. He said, when you're driving in fog, you slow down. And the idea that, like, we haven't had clean data coming out. Now, we did have, obviously, non-farm payroll data released, you know, but this was September numbers. So we got 119,000 jobs versus, 50,000 expectations. So a slightly stronger labor market. But we also had the August figures revised downwards to a decrease of 4,000 jobs, where previously it had been an increase of 22,000. So also the revision of the August number, you know, showing a little bit more weakness. We had unemployment ticking up slightly to 4.4%, which is for an economy, if you consider the South African context, that sounds amazing. And 4.4%, historically speaking, is still frictional. That's what you expect. That's basically full employment. But given what we saw kind of, you know, in the, you know, call it, I'd say 2017 to around 2020, just the pre-COVID years, we saw that unemployment handle getting into the threes, and that almost now has created what is possible for the US economy. So the next jobs report, the big one, is going to be the 16th, and there we're actually going to get the November figures and the October figures all at once. So this is going to be after the Fed meeting as well. So there's a lot of, you know, everyone who thought that they could go on holiday as traders, they can't. So we've still got a couple of weeks of work left in us.
And this is after a busy year that it has already been. Gary, let's wrap things up with some local developments. We received a voluntary trading update from APSA around their performance. Anything stand out to you from there?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. So APSA, you know, is you know, pretty much one of the cheapest banks in South Africa, especially if you look at like a one-year forward PE, you know, incredibly cheap. You know, one-year forward, we're looking at kind of like just under 7x earnings. And this is for a bank that's paying, you know, almost an 8% dividend yield. So to buy a company on 7x earnings when you're going to get an 8% dividend yield is just staggering. Now, its ROE is a lot lower than the other banks. When I say a lot lower, I mean, you're looking at historically around... we're looking at 14% at the moment, which isn't necessarily great when you compare it to something like Capitec or First Rand, which obviously delivers a lot more for shareholders. But in this trading update, you know, the ROE target is now quite clear through 2027 to 2030, 16 to 19%. So we would expect that to improve. Yeah, they gave they're saying mid-single digit revenue growth for 2026, which is not spectacular, but also this is an economy that's not growing. You know, their 2025 guidance was unchanged, but their credit loss ratio has been improving. They're talking about medium-term NII, which is net interest income growth. That's up a single digit. So overall, a fairly good trading statement. In a down day, it was enough to boost Absa's share price 2.5%. So I think the story around Absa at the moment is that, yes, it's a bank that probably isn't running as efficiently as, let's say, a First Rand, but it's priced that way as well. And this is certainly not a bank that's in trouble. stable. It's a bank that is slowly turning around. So for me, I look at a trading update like this, and I start to think that maybe there's an opportunity here. It's dirt cheap, and the South African banks are well capitalized. We're getting, you know, pretty good things out of the South African economy at the moment, and we've had better GDP forecasts coming from a number of different sources. We've had that S&P Global Ratings upgrade. We've been removed from the grey list. We've got no load shedding. We're seeing portfolio flows coming into South Africa again. So overall, I think good trading statement and maybe an opportunity.
Certainly lots of opportunities presenting themselves, and one has to wait and see whether or not those opportunities would be seen through to the December Santa rally. Gary and I will probably catch up around that as well, either before the end of the year or early next year. But for now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the portfolio manager and director at Rand Swiss, Gary Boysen, for joining us to reflect on market movements as well as some of market's big sentiment drivers heading into the final interest rate decision out of the US this week.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
7:05 was the time this morning when the SPAR Group Limited released their audited group results for the 52 weeks ended 26 September 2025, a reflection on the performance of the financial year that was. We're going to be taking a look at these numbers in a bit more detail with the Group Chief Financial Officer at the SPAR Group, Reeza Isaacs. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of the performance. Reeza, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Net debt from a group perspective down by 40%. There's a wind up of the European strategic business. We're seeing some improvements from a revenue perspective. How do you reflect on the year that was from a business perspective?
Jimmy, so firstly, thank you for having me on your show, and good afternoon to your listeners. It's really good to be able to talk to you about our results. So Jimmy, yeah, it's been a year of I would say, you know, two halves, in a sense that, you know, from a financial results perspective, basically the performance on the income statement is not quite where we want it to be. You know, it's been tough to get growth in some of our markets, but, you know, we've managed to protect margins, gross margins. Our cost control has been good, and we've managed to generate decent cash flow, which has had a positive impact on our balance sheet. So what I'm really excited about is the fact that our net debt, as you mentioned earlier, has come down by 40%, and our gearing from a group point of view is now under 2x. So, you know, it's very, very different to the picture a year ago. So, and more importantly, we've simplified the group. We've disposed of Poland. We've disposed of Switzerland. These investments not just took capital from the group, but they also took up a lot of management time. And we can now devote our time to, you know, our two core markets, which is Ireland and South Africa. So I'm very pleased that we're creating a foundation on which, a solid foundation on which we can grow.
Reeza, let's stay with competitiveness and take a look at the pet store business. It seems that SPAR is not the only retailer going into the pet market. We've seen some of your competitors do the same thing. And from a business perspective, I want to get your thoughts around what that diversification means for a business like the SPAR Group to be able to then offer your existing customer base a new convenience and a new service.
Thanks, Jimmy. I think it's, look, just generally from, you know, a growth perspective, we're looking at all sorts of adjacencies, you know, including, you know, partnerships with the likes of Vida. Health is another trend that is emerging, which is not new, but then also pets. I mean, I think we've seen the pet phenomenon sort of explode really during COVID and continue, you know, post that. So you're right. I mean, our competitors have invested quite substantially in this particular category, which shows you just what the opportunities are within that sector. And I think the sector itself has consolidated. It has formalized. Your moms and pops have, you know, have now been effectively consolidated into bigger corporates. And what we are offering is effectively with our independent retailer model, we are offering independent pet businesses the opportunity to convert into pet store. And we replicate effectively the SPAR distribution model, you know, in respect of those entities. and we, they can get effectively their supplies, their pet food, their accessories, directly from one source at a good price. And I think that's how we're helping or assisting the sector consolidate effectively as well by replicating the SPAR distribution model, in the pet market.
Reza, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the outlook for the new financial year. You touched on the fact that margin protection is exceptionally important, or at least it was exceptionally important in this previous year, and I can imagine it will continue to be a priority in restoring the South African margin as well over the coming year. But I want to take a look at that in the context of everything that the SPAR Group has going on. There's that joint venture taking place still in Sri Lanka. There are other plans to focus on the local markets that you touched on earlier around South Africa and the Irish market. Take us through the outlook for 2026 or the 2026 financial year and how that's influencing some of the strategic positioning that the SPAR Group is undergoing.
Yeah, we are seeing, look, we've made our strategic disposals. We're on the path of, I think we've really stabilized the balance sheet. That I think is, been a big win, especially from a finance perspective. And I think we continue to invest to transform the business. I mean, we do have old systems. We need to, complete our SAP implementation and some of the back office systems needs to be replaced. And we need to invest in initiatives that that is going to drive growth, like SPAR2U, like health, like Pet Story. Those initiatives, do come with some costs. But we do have opportunities for efficiencies within the business. We're still on a turnaround journey with our KZN DC, and we do also have, growth opportunities, both in private label and, as I said, in these adjacencies. But we will be tackling a number of initiatives on the efficiency side, on the growth side, centralization side, and cost management side, which will hopefully lay the foundation for us to get to the 3% over the medium term.
Reza, can we take a look at perhaps what might have been the monkey on SPAR's back for the longest time, and that is that SAP implementation. It's been a struggle for the business over several financial reporting cycles. Understandably, you haven't been part of all of those reporting cycles, but can we just take a look at where we stand on that today and what the business is looking to do in that respect?
The implementation itself, like you said, I was involved in it. It was tackled, in a big bang type of approach, top down, including offshore operations and that, and including the warehouse system, and that has been completely, that's been slowed down. We've stabilized the implementation at KZN, which is the first DC in which we implemented SAP, and from KZN, now that we've stabilized KZN, we are going to be rolling it out on a systematic basis. I think Angelo mentioned that, up until the first quarter of, which takes us up to the first quarter of 2028. And I must say, the governance, the project management, the way in which the teams are organized, the program assurance that we having over this particular, implementation is very structured. And it is being done in a very, very systematic, very controlled way. And clearly we cannot have, a repeat of what's gone before, both for ourselves and for our retailers, because it did have a significant impact on not just our profitability, but the profitability of our retailers, and hence why we lost loyalty, especially in KZN.
The SPAR Group remains focused on its core markets and delivering to its core consumer base. We're going to leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the Chief Financial Officer at SPAR Group Limited, Reza Isaacs, for joining us to reflect on the year that was and potentially look at the strategy going into the new financial year.
On the farm, every season brings challenges. Will the rain come? Will the soil deliver enough? But I'm not facing those challenges alone. With Omnia by my side, I receive more than fertilizer. I have access to science, innovative solutions, and people who care about my success.
At Omnia, your best harvest is our greatest achievement. Together we grow more than crops, we grow futures. Contact Omnia today and start growing your future.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The team at Netflix have approached Warner Brothers, one of the oldest studios in the world, to potentially acquire some of their assets. This is off the back of Warner Brothers looking to spin off and let go of some of its channels, including the likes of CNN and TNT. This deal, however, relates to the digital side of the business, in particular looking at film and TV and the HBO streaming platform. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the sales director at Reach Africa, Leslie Adams. He joins me on the line to see what we make of these developments. Leslie, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly an interesting time to announce this kind of conversation. Now, we know as it stands at the moment, it is very much a conversation, but this could potentially go down as one of the biggest deals for 2025.
Absolutely. It's quite an interesting one. Just off the back of our own acquisition with Canal Plus and DStv locally, it's actually following the trend globally that really it's the time of consolidation across the sort of content space, where the new set of TV rules or cinema rules or content owner rules is being rewritten.
Leslie, you bring up the Canal Plus and MultiChoice deal. Now, they're going to be affected by this as well, as we have received kind of conversations around the fact that the Warner Brothers channels would likely disappear from a DStv by the end of the year. We know that's still up in the air. That could be very well renewed and changed by the time you and I catch up next year. But deals like this have fundamentally, they have an impact on the consumer base and on what it is that we then have access to. How do we now make sense of this deal and the repositioning it does or it allows for Netflix as well as for Warner Brothers?
I mean, it's a great question. From a consumer perspective, the rules of access is being completely rewritten. I mean, we talk to our clients and we have the story about, you know, in the very early days of television, it was simply an aerial that evolved into an MA decoder, a DStv decoder. And then, you know, in the internet age, the age of streaming meant that you had to have internet to access premium content on demand. This particular acquisition has really sort of wide rolling impacts across the different verticals of how content is distributed, how it is consumed, who has access to it, what kind of access to that, and what the licensing landscape will look like. Because what's really interesting about Warner Brothers is that they're a large licensing business where they sell licensing to the likes of broadcast partners globally or content partners globally, where historically streaming partners like a Netflix, for example, tend to keep their content in-house and to access that content, you need to become a subscriber. So that will be a real interesting thing to see unfold. And Warner Brothers also has a large sport portfolio. What it will look like in terms of Netflix's long-term sport ambitions, because they have been sort of dabbling in this live sports space with boxing and here and there in different areas. This will actually shortcut that route because they'll acquire the licensing with this purchase, which means that they'll suddenly have access to live sports in different markets almost immediately. And what that will mean for the consumer could mean better, a wider and deeper access to different content on Netflix. All these brands or legacy brands from Warner Brothers will continue to exist. What we do know is that, you know, broadcasters relied on Warner Brothers for licensing. So DStv is a great example. Not only is it 12 channels, but HBO, which is the marquee sort of content partner of DStv, which brought us the Game of Thrones, House of Dragons, and more, they are also falling part of this deal. So that will impact even the premium international content that we see locally. And we might see that fundamentally change.
Leslie, what are your thoughts on market competitiveness? You touched on the fact that consolidation seems to be taking place here, but one can't ignore the fact that if we are to follow the Netflix business model where they would own all of their content and only have it available on their platform, Disney Plus has done something quite similar there as well, pulling the Marvel content from Netflix and only housing it on their platforms. Does this then create an anti-competitive environment by reducing the amount of players there? Is this kind of consolidation a good thing where we have a lot of these streaming services out there already?
So, I mean, it's a great question because, one, we don't know if this deal will even be approved by the regulator, because it is, on the face of it, seems quite anti-competitive to have a content duopoly. And as we know, many of these deals in the past have actually gone through with conditions, and we expect the same to happen with Netflix and Warner Brothers. For example, a few years ago when Disney acquired Fox, it was a very similar scenario, buying a competing broadcaster and streaming sort of competitor, further consolidating the market. What we do know is a couple of things. One, I think the current price we pay globally to stream this content is way below what it actually costs to create and distribute this content. So one way or the other, the cost of streaming is going to go up. So locally, for example, we've had the premise given that streaming is cheaper than pay TV. Well, that's about to change as things sort of level out and we pay what streaming is actually worth, or at least manage when they manage their cost. Globally, streaming costs from subscribers have gone up sixfold probably in the last 18 to 24 months, which means increases are coming globally. Africa may be last, but it is coming. And when you look at consolidations like this, you're right, there are hundreds and hundreds of streaming platforms out there. Because of that, consolidation was always going to happen because the smaller players will just not make it in the profit game. They'll run out of cash and then be acquired. And if you look at Warner Brothers, which was poorly managed, it was rebranded HBO, HBO Max, and unbundled again with Discovery. They've had plenty and plenty of their own issues trying to get the business to be profitable and actually ultimately failed, which is why they are up for sale at this point in time. And in fact, it's quite interesting that Netflix is paying such a premium for it.
Speaking of that premium and the regulatory conversation that you brought up, Netflix seems to already be anticipating some pushback from the regulator. They have openly, without the regulators questioning or requiring this, offered up $5 billion as a breakup fee if the regulators don't approve the deal. So clearly they're anticipating that there could be some resistance, there could be some conversation to be had here, and they're prepared for that. What do you make of that going into the conversation?
If I'm being honest, I think it's a way of killing off businesses before they become too heavy a drain on the business already. Hollywood as a whole has gone through a massive sort of revolution, whether they've liked it or not. Since COVID and the writer's strike, Hollywood itself has not been profitable. It's actually been cheaper to create, shoot, and produce movies outside of the US. Hollywood as an idea may still be there, but the actual productions don't really happen in the US anymore. Warner Brothers has and owns local studios and production infrastructure on the US sort of ground. What it means is, you know, they can unbundle those sort of unprofitable businesses cheaply, by almost preempting that, because ultimately they're in the distribution game, not necessarily the creation game. This may change that, given the IP that they're acquiring. You know, things like the DC Universe. So if you think of the DC Universe, think of Batman, right? They will own Batman outright. They will own Harry Potter outright, and that's a really interesting thing from a content creation perspective. But it's not really been their game. They used to sort of buy and acquire content very cheaply, very early in the IP sort of game, and then market it through as a Netflix original. This will be a very big change in how they do business, but doesn't necessarily mean they want to acquire some of the businesses or legacy businesses that may not necessarily be viable going forward.
Leslie, what does that then mean for local content producers and content platforms? What can they learn from this? I mean, I'm thinking about the ownership conversation you're bringing up, and what comes to mind is something like the James Bond franchise that now sits with Amazon's MGM Studios. If we're looking at a platform locally, say, for example, Showmax, that is in the competitive space from a streaming platform, is going up against these streaming giants in the form of Netflix and the like. How then do you position your value proposition as a brand, as an offering, and what does that then do? Because consumers effectively have all of the choice. It's just about now convincing them to put the product or to put their money with you.
So, I mean, what's really interesting in the streaming space is that consumers are fickle. And when we look at a lot of these international mergers, it is driven by large international sort of franchises out there. And a really great example of this is Disney and the Star Wars franchise. The Star Wars franchise in Western Europe and the US is bang on bang for your buck. They will spend $100 million without batting an eye because they would know they will make that money back. Not necessarily true for the African market. The African market needs local, authentic content. And this is where platforms like Showmax can position themselves differently and uniquely, even though they may lose things like Game of Thrones or House of Dragons, or Batman for that matter. But what they do have is local content through a long-standing heavy investment from DSTV pre-Canal, and hoping that continues in that vein, which will be a real differentiator, especially on the continent. Even as massive global streamers struggle to compete here because what they believe works in Western Europe, they want to copy and paste here, and that's not necessarily true. And that's been a really interesting space, because even Netflix, as I spoken earlier on about how globally the massive increases for subscription prices has happened, the crackdown on password sharing has happened, the launch of advertising has happened, it has not happened here. In fact, the baseline entry level for Netflix is $100, which is where Showmax competes currently, but at least Showmax trades in rands, whereas for Netflix, that $100 price tag is actually well below their cost level. So it's quite an interesting one, because they're still fighting to acquire mass and scale in our local environment, and yet not succeeding and competing quite heavily with the likes of Showmax, which at different quarters actually outscale them in terms of overall subscriber growth.
Certainly some interesting developments in the streaming world as we reflect on some deals and potential acquisitions that are in the works. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the sales director at Reach Africa, Leslie Adams, for joining us to reflect on the announcement by Netflix that they would potentially be looking to enter into a deal with Warner Brothers and how that could affect the rest of the market.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Truecaller, the app that we all use for identifying who's phoning you and who is trying to spam you, is currently under investigation by the Information Regulator of South Africa. That is, of course, the regulatory body that aims to continue to protect our privacy and information sharing in South Africa. They're investigating them for a number of potential violations and breaches that have been brought to their attention. For more on this, we're going to be taking a look at this with the editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, and he joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Jan, lovely as always to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. What is this investigation centered around, and what brought it about?
Yeah, good day. It's a pleasure to be here. In essence, what's happened here is a group of people have laid a complaint with the information regulator. So that immediately spurs it to action. And the essence of the complaint is that Truecaller allows people to label businesses as spammers or fraudsters or scammers. And that does those businesses harm. And then the only way out for those businesses, they allege, is to subscribe to Truecaller's service to have them appear on a green or gold background. So you get like a gold or platinum subscription service as a business, and then get a different background on the app. But Truecaller says that the allegations are false. And while we're just laying it out there, it does seem a little bit like a bunch of spammers have laid complaints at the information regulator about this, to try and minimize Truecaller's impact on their business model.
Now, this is particularly interesting, Jan, because we know that we do have a spammer and scammer problem in South Africa and around the world, and companies like Truecaller are often dragged into this because they are able to facilitate the conversations, or whether or not they share the information or not, that is potentially where the POPIA Act comes in, or the POPI Act, as we know it, the Protection of Public Information Act. How then does Truecaller respond to its responsibilities around that?
Yeah, they're very careful about the wording they choose. So I'm going to paraphrase a little here, because it's an interesting philosophical debate. Now, at issue here as well is that Truecaller, in some incarnations, allow people to upload their contacts list to the Truecaller, or at least they used to. I don't know if they still do this, but they used to allow you to upload your contacts list to Truecaller and then get certain features in exchange for that, rather than paying a subscription service or you know, you gain access to a different kind of lookup or whatever the case might be. Now, Truecaller has said that, firstly, that no longer happens. And secondly, a point they made that I think is very valid is that there's an exchange happening here. The Truecaller service only works if people share a certain amount of data with it. Essentially, so it functions like an old school phone book. And so there needs to be an understanding that some sacrifice of people's private data allows people to make informed decisions about whose call they want to accept. And I think that's a valuable philosophical discussion to have about where we draw the line with regards to protection of personal information in South Africa. Do we allow the privacy rights of certain individuals or corporations to be infringed to protect the greater majority of people who don't want to be spammed and defrauded and scanned, but then also run the risk of an innocent person being targeted by vindictive people who then has their number blacklisted? So there's I think a very valuable discussion to have here about how these services operate and potentially what kind of recourse an innocent person might have to say, no, but I'm not a fraudster or a scammer or a you know, or a spammer. I would like to appeal this decision in Truecaller. What's my recourse for that? And so there's a lot of nuance to this that I think often gets left by the wayside in our Twitter discussions about it.
Now, Jan, part of the conversations that we have on these socials and related to these platforms is ultimately a company like Truecaller is rendering a service that South Africans and many people around the world are comfortable with using because it does benefit them in some way, shape or form. How do you balance that as part of these nuanced conversations with the responsibilities that should be in place, whether it's from a Truecaller perspective, from a policy and a legislative perspective? How do we now start to kind of navigate the conversations around utility versus, as you said, rights that are afforded to consumers?
Yeah, so the way I see it, there's two possible solutions to this. One is Truecaller. Truecaller has obviously seen a need in the market, a gap, something that everybody wants and needs, and has responded to it by providing that service. On the other side, you can have let's call it a more state-sanctioned or government-provided service, but those are almost always weaker and either it gets infected with corruption or there are loopholes that get exploited. And so on. Whereas a for-profit entity like Truecaller is incentivized to make sure that its service works as well as possible. Because I would not be paying Truecaller a subscription service, a subscription fee, if it didn't work well, right? And so yeah, you sit with this conundrum where you go, because it's the users of Truecaller who are uploading their contacts information, phone numbers, and it's not like, you know, ID numbers, it's their names and phone numbers that get uploaded to the Truecaller service. And then Truecaller lets users around the world, you know, report if something is spam or not. And so the other question to ask is, where does the individual's responsibility begin and end? Does Truecaller make it clear enough to the individual that, hey, listen, you're about to upload somebody's contact information to our service. Are you sure you want to do this? Do you have their permission? And so there's perhaps that nuance to look at rather than, you know, going, you know, with a too black or white approach here. There's some responsibility that resides with us as users of Truecaller. There's some responsibility that resides with the platform Truecaller itself. And then also potentially with legislators to go, hang on a second, POPIA is too blunt an instrument here, because we can all see that a service like Truecaller is is not only useful, it is necessary. And so perhaps it should, the regulations and the legislation should be amended to reflect that fact, that we as a society have actually communally agreed that we want Truecaller and we want it to be legal.
Some important considerations when looking at protecting our information and the use of that information, whether you're a private individual or a business. We'll see how this investigation continues to unfold and what comes of it. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, for joining us to take a look at the latest investigation by the information regulator into Truecaller and its use in South Africa.
Running a business can feel like a solo mission. I mean, you've got the hustle. If only your office Wi-Fi was your employee of the month. Turn on your success with Telkom Business, the partner that always shows up. Get a reliable 25 by 25 megabytes per second connection with Stream Connect Fiber for only 489 rands per month.
This summer, your business deserves the best. Visit telkom.co.za/business for deals that connect your business. T's and C's apply. Telkom Business. Possible begins here.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Just an interesting update on that Warner Brothers Netflix conversation that we had a little earlier. It seems as though following off from that, we've just learnt via Bloomberg that Paramount has made a hostile bid for Warner Brothers at $30 a share. So that seems to be a very fluid conversation, a developing story, and certainly going to present some exciting conversations around that transaction, whether or not it goes through or not. But we move on to the other conversations that we said we would be having today, and that we're taking a look at the luxury market. It seems as though some of the performers in the luxury market haven't been as lackluster as others. In fact, some South African brands in particular have been outperforming some of their global peers where it comes to the second-hand or pre-loved markets. For more on this, we're joined on the line by our expert in pre-loved luxury, co-founder at Luxity, Michael Zahariev, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Michael, lovely to catch up. It's been a while since you and I have spoken. What is the state of the luxury market at the moment? Seemingly, this is a very competitive space.
Yes, and thank you for having me once again on your show. And as you mentioned, the luxury market is a very competitive space and it's forever adapting. And one of the interesting things that we've seen happening this year is really this change away from brand loyalty, but more into brands that hold their return. So what we've seen is this kind of this rise of the savvy luxury investment shopper, where they're looking not only at what brand is the most popular, but at more specifically, if I'm looking to sell my brand down the line, what brand is going to return the more of the money so that I'm able to get some of that money back and reinvest it into the luxury economy. So that's really showing some standouts, particularly in the fashion ateliers space, like Chanel, Hermes, which are a lot have a lot less supply in South Africa, and also in categories like watches and jewelry, which are up phenomenally compared to other spaces because of that ability to hold their value over time.
Now, Michael, when we look at value retention, for the longest time, we have been told that certain luxury brands from certain parts of the world retain more value or retain better value than other brands. But if we look at the performances of some of the local brands, and I want to include Cartier in that brand as a local brand because it was founded by a South African and continues to be owned by Richemont, I want to look at that. I want to look at brands like Browns, and you compare them to international jewelry brands that have existed potentially for equally as long. Are you surprised to see that investors are now saying, hang on, the value retention aspect of it isn't limited to a certain country?
Yes, I think that's the exciting thing. So what we've been able to see, and I mean, it took Luxity 7 years just to, you know, try have a local luxury brand like Browns. We weren't sure if the market was ready for it. We weren't sure if locals really valued them the same as the international heavyweights. So we are quite surprised that when we did launch Browns onto the platform, that it was doing just about roughly 10% less than the heavyweights in the industry, you know, the global recognized leaders in the jewelry industry. So this has really excited us to see that South Africans do value local brands very close to or in competition with the international brands. You know, it's not just a case of I want the big international names. And we're quite excited to introduce more and more local brands over time. And it speaks to the value of it's not just about the name brand, but it's about the craftsmanship and the legacy, etc. as well.
Michael, what does that then mean for the future of luxury, both locally and internationally? We know that in the world of luxury, it's probably one of the few spaces where pre-loved, as you like to refer to the things that you sell and the commodities that you sell, that pre-loved market in the luxury space can often eclipse the new market in very many aspects. What does that mean for the future of that world if the focus is now shifting very clearly to quality over just name?
Well, I think there's so many shoppers that are starting to awaken to this idea of pre-owned or pre-loved luxury that the future is really endless. And when we look at it, I think, you know, an analogy is quite a good one to look at is that the pre-owned luxury space globally right now is about 5% of the new sector. Now, if we compare that to a more established sector such as the car industry, where at one stage there also wasn't a pre-owned segment, but now the pre-owned segment in the car industry is roughly 2.5 times the new segment. So it just shows you of how much growth there is still to have in this market and how consumers are starting to find many different ways to benefit from this, not just for a discount, but for accessing limited edition pieces, accessing rarer pieces, using it for trading, which is often why it trades at more than new. So it's really exciting time of growth, and we're set to see many, many more changes across the pre-owned luxury segment specifically.
One thing about consumers is they will always tell you what they consider important to them. And for some, investing in luxury is important in whatever shape or form it does take. I think for now we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the co-founder at Luxity, Michael Zahariev, for joining us to reflect on the state of the luxury market in South Africa and how it ranks globally.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's personal finance time on a Monday. This week we are dipping into travel insurance, everything you need to know about it and how to make the most of it. I'm joined on the line for this conversation by the marketing specialist at TIC at Santam, Simi Mikeli, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Simi, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the very basics. What is travel insurance and how many different types of travel insurance are out there?
Travel insurance is a once-off purchase that a traveler will make when traveling either internationally or domestically, and typically would cover internationally emergency medical costs and cover costs for trip disruptions and your personal belongings.
So, Simi, when I think about travel insurance, what are some of the considerations as a traveler that need to be top of mind here?
When choosing travel cover, you would want to match your policy to your destination and activities, not just look at the price. You want to make sure it includes strong medical protection, cover for the disruptions and the luggage. But in terms of the activities, for example, a business traveler or a traveler working abroad might be doing some manual labor or working with machinery, usually excluded on a standard policy, this traveler type would require a policy that includes cover for that kind of work. Or an adventure traveler might be indulging in an activity that's not automatically excluded. You would seek to check whether that is covered or whether you would need to purchase additional cover.
So, I mean, often when we think about travel insurance, the immediate thought that comes to mind is, oh, I don't need it, or, oh, my medical aid offers me that level of insurance for the particular trip. But in looking at travel insurance, it's not limited to the medical expenses only. What other travel insurances should people be thinking about when looking at trips? And does it vary if we're looking at a longer term stay or a shorter trip?
Yes, indeed. So most banks and some medical schemes will provide some kind of medical protection when you travel internationally. You would want to ensure that your medical benefit is adequate. For example, traveling to the USA, USA tops the list of the most costly country, especially for travelers. You would want to make sure you have adequate medical cover, and you would want to add cover for your trip disruptions and your luggage. So that would incur a once-off cost for the additional cover.
So, do the considerations change from a travel perspective and an insurance perspective depending on the life situations of individuals? So, for example, if I'm traveling alone versus traveling with a family, does that then affect, or traveling with an elderly parent, does that then affect the types of insurance that I might want to think about? And are there different types of insurance to cover different types of family scenarios?
Typically, insurers will have a look at whether you're traveling for business purposes or leisure purposes. That's the differentiation. Insurers will want to know which destination you're traveling to. Some of the high-risk destinations might attract an additional premium. And if you're traveling as a family, you can opt to have your children share cover for free within the cover of their parents.
So, Sammy, when we look to the travel considerations, what are some of the important things to remember from an insurance perspective where it relates to the fine print? Because some of these policies or these types of covers are for a brief period of time or a limited period of time and not like the typical other types of insurance products that we have. But at the same time, they do still carry fine print.
Quite right. Spending a few minutes reading your policy before your trip is worthwhile. The fine print will explain what to do in an emergency, what documents you'll need for a claim. Importantly, it's not just about exclusions, it's also about conditions of cover. For example, A standard travel insurance policy for South African travel insurance, you must be a permanent resident of South Africa traveling on a return journey. If you were traveling for the purpose of immigrating, you would be excluded from cover on a regular policy and you'd need an immigration specific cover. And also an important condition of cover would be that you must purchase your policy prior to departure. So understanding conditions will ensure that you have the right cover and you're not left without cover when you need it most.
So is it possible to then cover the trip itself? So understandably, we can cover ourselves from a medical standpoint. We can cover unforeseen events that might occur whilst we are away on this trip. Is it possible to obtain travel insurance then for the trip itself? If, for example, it's a personal trip and something else happens. The COVID pandemic showed us that flights, accommodations, things can be cancelled almost overnight, and one then has to wonder, how can we protect ourselves from that?
Certainly. Travel is a big financial commitment and you want to protect that investment. A comprehensive policy will include cover for trip disruptions, covering unforeseen events such as an unexpected illness or injury prior to departure, strikes, or severe weather. And this would ensure that non-refundable costs, your flights, accommodation, tour bookings are reimbursed if something unexpected prevents you from traveling. In an example that travelers can relate to, South Africans love traveling to cyclone-prone Mauritius. A good policy would cover your non-refundables or any additional costs if flights were cancelled due to the bad weather.
It's important to remember, folks, that travel insurance is not just paperwork that you use for your visa applications, but it can be the difference between you having a really good trip and having an absolutely disastrous one. Definitely something worth considering. But for now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Simi Michele, the marketing specialist at Santam Travel Insurance, for joining us to take a look at the importance of travel insurance and how it can benefit you.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, of course, we will be making them available as podcasts for you to catch up on them when you have time for that. We'll also be keeping an eye on some of the developments that are going to be coming out of the US this week. We are expecting, of course, that all-important interest rate decision out of the Fed, and seeing how that will potentially influence markets and what we make of that. But for now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hose is going to be standing by with the SAFM News team to bring you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.